Ready graphics? Ready theme?
Hi, I'm Jessie Mullins.
And I'm Lauren Milberger.
And this is FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast.
Frank, no.
I want this necklace so badly.
This is crazy.
Fontana gifts are unreturnable.
Saccharin is not Murphy Brown.
Frank actually did good, in spite of him.
Happy accidents are fun.
And on today's episode,
we'll be talking about Season 3, Episode 9, The Bummer of 42. I would sing the birthday song right now, but we know that Murphy doesn't like that.
It's funny, I feel like I don't entirely know if I believe that statement in the
episode.
Oh,
really? That she doesn't like the birthday song? I mean, it makes her so unique, I feel. Like, so it's kind of cute.
It does. Well, it does. And I think I had originally believed it until I saw who was saying it in the episode. And I was like, is that a real thing? Or is that like made up for the artifice of the relationship? Because what I think is so interesting is Murphy's clearly so into her birthday that the idea that she doesn't like the birthday song is
Listen, maybe she prefers the Stevie Wonder birthday song. A lot of people do.
I honestly do as well myself. Also, I just, fun fact about that song.
Yeah.
I, one year for Martin Luther King Jr. Day, had the day off because it was like a long weekend or whatever. And I decided to go check out the nearby Unitarian Church. Unitarians are delightful people to me. And we were new to the area, so I decided to check it out. And because it was the weekend of Martin Luther King Jr., that was their worship song, because that song is about MLK.
Oh, how cool.
Isn't that cool?
Right before you told the story, it dawned on me why they added that to the script. Because at the time, Happy Birthday was very expensive to get the rights for.
Oh my gosh. That makes complete sense.
The reason that I forgot was because very recently in 2016, there was a lawsuit in which the song was declared public domain.
Yeah.
It really was sort of known in the industry for a very long time that, like, this song is ridiculously priced. Like, the person who's doing this knows what they have, and there is no way that anyone will ever use it because it is so expensive.
Which is insane to me.
It feels really Scrooge McDuck.
100% it feels Scrooge McDuck. I know exactly what you mean, and I agree. But as somebody who, one of the worst things that you could do to me on my birthday is sing this song to me, and especially sing this song in front of other people to me. I hate it. I was a little girl who, like, if you sang it to me at the restaurant, I would literally fall underneath the table and hide. I hate it so much. So I felt a kinship. And so I'm just going to continue believing that she truly doesn't like it so that I can have this kinship.
I feel like as much as Murphy likes to be the center of attention, I think I could passably believe that the association of being in a restaurant or being with like a group of people with she doesn't want to be around.
It's very saccharin.
Exactly. And saccharin is not Murphy Brown. You know, I always think of this as the only birthday episode from Murphy Brown because I always forget that there is a birthday episode in the final season.
Oh, God, you're right.
Obviously, they didn't remember this episode, which happens a lot, you know, when different showrunners, you know, come up. But it just feels like more. Well, here's the thing, right? What you establish first is canon, and then anything that becomes a retcon is a retcon, right? So the May-April birthday is a retcon, or we just, you know, assume that it happened in November and...
Yeah, that's a thing we see a lot happen with people with whether or not they have siblings. That happens in shows all the time, where there's like an offhanded comment that then someone decides to expand upon later and we completely change the family unit because it was an early comment. So, yeah, it's...
And I know it's hard, right, because it was on for 10 seasons. There's a lot of story that you weren't even there for. But my understanding is that there's supposed to be a Bible, right? Like a Bible that's kept that has all of that kind of information in it. So I don't know. But they wanted to do a birthday episode in the final season, and maybe that's the only time they had to do it. So...
Sure.
You know.
In my head, this is her birthday.
This episode, The Bummer of 42, is a pun off of the film The Summer of 42. It is written by Tom Palmer, his second of the season. It is directed by Barnett Kelman, and it aired November 26, 1990, which we will assume is Murphy's birthday.
And for those who are following and paying attention and ascribe to some of these fun things, that makes Murphy a Sagittarius, which I truly have no initial impressions on, other than I'm like, ah, yes, she's a fire sign.
Same. I only really know like mine and like my family. And so if I meet someone who has the same sign as one of my family, I go, oh, I know like what you're supposed, you know, obviously like well, not obviously, but I personally just take it all with a grain of salt. I think it's fun. Don't know if I necessarily believe in it, but a lot of times it really lines up, which is a little creepy.
Yeah, it's a nature versus nurture thing, and I think it's really fun. I think that there are too many similarities with people who are not necessarily from the same family.
Agreed.
I tend to collect the same signs in my life, and they all seem to have some similarities that, hey, one of my favorite TikTokers says, I'm not a scientist nor a Keebler elf, so I can't speak on this, but I do find it fascinating. So a brief description is Sagittarius is a mutable sign, meaning it's associated with adaptability and flexibility. This perfectly represents the archer's deep-rooted desire for change. Sagittarians are born to explore, and it is critical that these archers have the freedom to roam. Huh. Fueled by wanderlust. Wanderlust can be found traversing all the corners of the world on thrill-seeking expeditions, chasing after geographical, intellectual, and spiritual adventures. Sagittarians are on a perpetual quest for knowledge, which makes them incredible storytellers, entertainers, and creatives. It's not all fun and games, however. Oh. Sagittarius is notorious for its signature bluntness, and their brutal honesty can often lead to misunderstandings, communication breakdowns, and lots of hurt feelings.
This is crazy!
But the good news, Sagittarius doesn't take anything too seriously, so it's hard to stay mad at these wild optimists.
This is crazy because I absolutely promise you that the writers were not thinking this. They probably just went, let's do a Murphy birthday episode during sweeps. Like, I do not
truly
think that they were.
Those who are listening to this right now, our writer friends who are listening, are like, why are they spending so much time on this? Yeah. None of us thought this far about it. But
stop,
you know what? Well
credit.
Done. Well done, Tom and team, for, in my opinion, nailing it based off this one summary that I found with a quick Google search.
I love happy accidents. Happy accidents,
I know, it
are
makes
fun.
Me happy.
So here is the TV guide. Frank surprises Murphy on her birthday with the sister she never had and doesn't want after she can't shake the fake sibling. I mean, to the point, not as punny, as interesting
sure.
as some of our other ones, but, you know, to the point.
It gives you what they're selling.
So should we go into the episode?
So we open with a montage. And when I was first watching this, I was like, oh, little kid birthday parties. And the first picture is this little girl at this giant dining room by herself. And I was like, that feels like that's a real Candace picture. And then they're going through and I was like, okay, do I recognize anyone else? And I wasn't sure. And I wasn't sure. And I was like, maybe until Baby Grant showed up. And that's when I was like, ah, yes, this was all of the cast.
Someone who has not changed. Yeah, because it's been a long time. It's been since like beginning or halfway through season two where we've had like a montage that matches the credits like this, which I think is really adorable when they do that. But yeah, Grant is perfect.
My God, he's the same.
Hasn't changed a bit. But also the picture of Joe looks like some professional.
It's
like
incredible.
The lighting is gorgeous. He's blowing out candles and you're like, wow, like someone in your family was really good at photography.
Great at this. I have to say, because we know like kind of Candace's upbringing.
It's sad.
And what she grew up in. That picture makes me really sad.
It's very sad. Yeah.
She's this little girl in this big room. And I was like, oh, Candace, Candy. If you know the context of her childhood, there's so much to that picture, is all I'm saying.
It can also fit into Murphy's childhood.
Exactly. It's incredible. But before we get into the actual episode out of the montage of the Sweet Babies, the song.
So the name of the song is called The Birthday Party. And it's by, now you tell me, Jesse, a group of three white women that I have never heard of, called The Pixies Three. Not The Pixies, The Pixies Three. Ever heard of them?
What?
I'm asking if you ever heard of them.
Oh, I have not. No.
I assumed you didn't.
No.
I just wanted to check because I have never heard of them. And I can't remember if I only know this song, which is probably right, from this episode because I've seen it so many times. Mm. But it made me think of, you know, Leslie Gore, It's My Party, I'll Cry If I Want To, right? Like, so it's that same sort of like early 60s. I feel like for a lot of our audience, a great example would be the beginning of Hairspray. Right?
Yeah.
Like the early 60s were very different from the mid to late 60s. The music was different. You're coming in from the 50s. But what's interesting is that girl groups in general really became very popular. I just think that the ones that we know now are more like Motown, the people who just like hit after hit after hit. Now, what's interesting about Leslie Gore, and I hate to make this about Leslie Gore, is that making her sort of separated from, say, the Pixies 3, is that she started doing things like You Don't Own Me, which we all know, of course, from the First Wives Club, which is why I bring it up, where all of a sudden it's becoming anthems, where young teenagers, which are the baby boomers, which was a huge generation and really started changing the way that entertainment and music and the world in general in terms of performance was catering to children, which was very new. I think today we don't realize that, right? So there are all these teenagers who are singing about love, singing about their party albums were sort of a big deal. So their only hits were The Birthday Party and 442 Glenwood Avenue, which sounds familiar to some other songs that we've talked about where it's the phone number. The themes of the song are pretty obvious. It's just about a boy that you like or the address where he lives or something like that. So The Birthday Party was their first single, made the top 40 nationally, and it was on an album called Party with the Pixies 3, which is considered actually an early rock and roll concept album, which is interesting, based on sort of the idea of it's Friday and after school, you and your friends are going to just go to a party and listen to albums.
I mean, I love that linguistic quirk of saying something and then the number of it in that, like, the Pixies 3, the Berenstain Bears, whatever, that's it, like the Pixies 3, the Musketeers 3, the, like, that thing of, like, flipping linguistically. So I it's a clever name of a band because I think it is like Party with the Pixies 3. It like, it's a fun little thing, but I just wish I knew more about them.
Yes, I wish I did know more about them. And just to give them their due, there were several members up until 2010. So it's one of those sort of old groups that most likely on like PBS, right? You'd probably see them get together. And I am sorry that I don't have a lot of information on them, but they just only had two songs. And it's from a time when, you know, the music was just so rich and so many hits that the internet is great, but there's just not a lot of stuff on there. So I apologize to the Pixie 3. We have Midge Neal, Bonnie Walker, Kay Cribbs, and Deborah Horn. So there were four of them, but there were always three.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it's a very cute, fun song. And it fits perfectly into this episode.
And I love seeing the cast and their younger
it's really sweet
because
it's
really sweet, and also I think it does a really great job without saying showing us the generational differences.
Yes,
just
that's
in like
really
the quality
why I really
of
like
the photos.
It. Yeah, absolutely.
You're like, ah, yes, your childhood picture looks very different than your childhood picture because of just technology and the furnishings. That like it says so much about the age diversity in this group, actually. So out of this montage, we are in the bullpen, the elevator doors open, and a man appears with a giant collection of oversized black balloons with skulls on them.
Of course.
Which, I'm sad no one's brought me this balloon arrangement now.
Well, perhaps when you're older.
Indeed, once I've earned it. He's walking in, he makes his way toward Murphy's office, and you can see that outside her office, all over the secretary's desk, and next to the door, and possibly inside, because we can kind of see, there is just a chaotic... a chaotic mountain range of presents.
Oh, yes. It's like a party, but just for Murphy.
Yes. And we will get a better view of this a little bit later. But we do see that this episode's secretary is an inflatable T-Rex holding a sign that says, I'm your new secretary.
Which may be one of the gifts.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're welcome. Here you go. It won't talk back. It'll just stand there. What I like about this featured actor is he walks it over and then you see him accidentally knock over some of the bigger presents. It's this little bit of business in the background where he goes to like set down the balloons and the big present in front of it gets knocked over as he's going, and he's just hastily trying to put them back. Kudos to props, because when it falls over, they are fully wrapped.
And it visually gives us a sense of like, wow, like this is a
There's
lot
so much
that someone can't even like get around them. Yeah.
Corky makes her way over to Jim, declaring that she hates Murphy's birthday. She recognizes that she's 42, and when she graduated from high school, Corky was one. But there's no reason to make them all miserable.
One of my favorite deliveries that Faith has ever done.
The dot, dot, dot.
But I also feel like now that I'm older than Corky, that joke lands like so different for me, and I find it even funnier.
Jim ponders that birthdays are peculiar creatures. Quote, the glory of youth fading into distant memory. Another wrinkle seen in the mirror that wasn't there yesterday. Your wife buying you a Barca lounger years before your time. So, correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
But I feel like the Barca lounger was the proto Lazy Boy.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, and it was very big. I feel like it was a buzzword in the 90s. Like
it was everywhere. I'm not sure that the younger generation understands what that means in the context of this joke.
And it's a company name, right?
That's Barca Lounger is the company. Yeah. And it's still going. When you hit a certain age and you needed that comfier, relaxing. So the idea that she gave him an old man's retirement chair.
It's the chair in Frasier.
Years before his time.
It's Marty's chair.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good example. Yes, it's Marty's chair. So he comes out of this horrified gaze that he gets when he talks about something that has ruffled him. And he says, some people have a hard time dealing with the fact that they're another year older. The elevator dings in that moment, and Murphy comes bursting out saying, hey, everybody, it's party time. To which Jim says, then there's Murphy.
Yes, which none of us are surprised about. I mean, Murphy would definitely be that girly who would be like, it's my birthday month. It's my birthday week. Did anyone know it was my birthday? My birthday's coming up. Like, and for many people, their birthday is the one day when they get a lot of attention. Murphy doesn't need that. But
no,
she loves to be the center of attention.
Yes.
Why wouldn't she like her own personal Christmas?
Well, and I think to the point we were making about the picture of Candace, like, alone in this, like, genteel dining room. The idea of, like, I don't think that for Murphy's birthday that it was the celebration with others that she would have wanted.
Oh, yeah.
As an adult, she finally gets to have the birthday she always wanted, which was, like, forcing her friends to hang out with her.
I'm surprised she's not registered somewhere.
Truly. She struts her way into the middle of the bullpen, saying there will be cake and singing and merriment with a 4 p.m. start. She looks over at her mountain range of gifts and goes, oh, there's more than last year. She thinks they're going for a record this year. And she knows that everyone there wants to wish her happy birthday in their own special ways, but they must wait because some of her gifts might be perishable. And she, like, scampers into her office.
Can we talk about her outfit, her birthday
Please.
Outfit? Oh my God, it's so good. Obviously, we hope that you're following along with the episode. The links are on our website, but obviously we also have it on our social media. So hopefully you are looking at it right now, or after this, you'll pause and like look on our social media or watch the episode because we would love that. Anyway, she is wearing this burgundy jacket, which you've seen her wear before, with a white button up with the collar just like popped. Ooh. With this silver necklace, which is not really even my thing, but again, love chunky jewelry on Murphy. And it's around, it's a little Diane Keaton-y, right? Like it's not on the skin, it's around the collar that's been popped up. Mm-hmm. And she just looks so fabulous. Oh, and then like her hair is sort of that lion mane. I used to think that it was a perm, but I think it's just her hair teased now because it keeps going back and forth sometimes this season. I just
love it. As someone who loves chunky, like,
bring it on.
Artist flea market jewelry of all metallics, the fact that it is a snake makes me, I want this necklace so badly. I have this, it reminds me of this necklace that I have from when I first moved to New York City and I bought it in one of those jewelry stores on Lexington that, you know, just like is full of random stuff. And it is just a giant, it's like a collar kind of like this, where it's like collar choker, a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
But this gives me the same vibe of like, it is such a statement. It's beyond what I think we'd now call a statement necklace. She's wearing a piece of art.
Yeah, she is. And she's wearing feminist silver.
Oh, it's incredible. So proud of her. So once she walks into her office, we think maybe she's going to be there for a while. And she walks back out towing a gift bowed Carl.
Oh, Carl.
Carl's wearing a giant, one of those giant kind of red velvet bows that you would buy at a department store perhaps, and the ribbon is wrapped around him several times, and she's holding him by the end of one of the ribbons, pulling him out, and I have to say, Rich Brinkley, this might be my favorite Carl episode.
It is, and it's the one time where like I'm on Murphy's side more than, not that she doesn't, she always treats him very well, but on this side, I'm like, yeah, step too far, Carl. Like, you're adorable because I love you, but if it were me, I'd be like, no, it's not happening.
I both believe Carl is so earnest and also doesn't expect her to actually take it. Like, to me, this doesn't cross into creepy because Carl would never force her to do anything.
No, he wouldn't. And I say that with a little
He's
bit of a
joke.
He's just so
hopeful.
You know what I mean? But it's like, okay, no.
He says he hasn't even unwrapped her yet. Good things come in big packages. And then he does the cutest little, like, stand and twist.
It's really adorable, yeah.
It's so non-threatening.
Very much so.
She says she appreciates the thought, but something tells her they'll both regret it if she untied this bow. And he just goes, I wouldn't. She says, try her at the end of the year. Her resistance is always down at the office Christmas party. And I'm just going to say, Murphy, if you don't want someone to hit on you anymore and you're getting fed up with it, which here's the thing. I'm not sure Murphy's entirely fed up with it. I do think Murphy loves the adoration.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, saying, absolutely. You
know? So Carl takes this as someone like Carl would, yeah, as, oh my God, I have a chance, and goes, yes. And then he just says to himself out to the audience, I knew these French cut jeans would get her sooner or later. And then just walks off, still bowed up.
He's so earnest.
I love him so much. As he's walking, we have the lovely kind of the wipe of screen, which is Carl going one way, and then Miles and Frank entering in the other, wiping across screen in a beautiful visual moment. Good job, Barnett. And Miles is giving Frank one more chance to go in on the group gift that Miles is holding. And it's a medium-sized box with a very elaborate bow on it. Frank says no, he doesn't need to go in on the group gift. Murphy is his best friend, and he always gets her something only he would think of. Miles says he holds in his hands the perfect gift.
Oh, Miles, no, it's not.
Jim comes around the coffee stand and is like, "And yes, it is. It was ingenious. They got her, someone who travels a lot, the perfect gift, a portable pants presser."
Yes, which honestly, I'm on Jim's side.
Perfect gift. Also, I love these moments when the writing is such a gift to a specifically like theatrical trained actor, because the way that Jim plays these plosives, the portable pants press,
yes,
like it's incredible.
When we interviewed Denise Moss, she talked about how, mm-hmm, Charles was so good at taking lines that on paper wouldn't be a huge laugh, and yeah, like turning it into a joke. And I
like,
think,
like, how do you not just relish in the triple P of the, yeah, portable pants presser?
It's great.
So good. Miles seems to internally wince a little bit. He says he needs to let them all know that he went in a different direction. He was in the store and saw something else. And then Frank says one of my favorite lines of the episode, solely because of Joe's delivery, mm-hmm, which is, better than a pants presser? That's hard to believe.
He's so good at that sort of mocking stuff. Like it's in moments like that that you're like, oh, this is why Murphy and Frank are like, ugh, really good friends. Like that, and they both are on that same plane, even though at one point they sort of divert where he becomes so neurotic and, you know, she's, yeah, would be like, I can't stand, you know, like just whatever, get over it kind of a thing.
And Miles reveals the thing he saw, the better thing he saw, was a home blood pressure check kit. Jim and Frank's faces of horror right behind his shoulder are incredible. A gift from the heart, for the heart.
So here's my question. What would you do if you were 42 and someone gave you a blood pressure kit? Because I would kill him.
I mean, my blood pressure would never be higher than the moment I received that kit.
Not to mention getting that gift from a younger person.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I have never been so not on Miles's side.
Yeah, I don't. It's.
And you know, he doesn't mean it, because Miles, yeah, would have totally bought that for himself. Now, of course, yeah, also, if you think about it, this is after the episode at the end of season 2, where they were all having stress problems and Murphy hurt her back. The two of them need this kind of help. But it doesn't, yeah, matter. A person of his age giving such a gift to a person of her age is such a mistake.
What I love is the way Joe has Frank just kind of back up out of this conversation now, because this is not his circus, not his monkeys. He's not in on this group gift. So he's not going to be here for when the other two launch in. To which Jim declares that Miles has had no right to go against the wishes, yeah, of the group. Corky stands up from the table now and says she wanted to get her an abdominizer.
Oh, Corky.
Which, if there is ever an 80s, 90s fitness gadget name, it's the abdominizer. Like, it is.
Thigh master.
Exactly. Yet again, the young person wanting to buy the old person something they want.
You know, we've learned throughout the last 3 years that it's not just Murphy who is a selfish human being. And you need to have some kind of ego to be on camera.
I love the moments when they're all more alike than they are different.
Same. It's great.
They all begin arguing over each other. The only one that I can pick out is Miles saying, I'm an executive. I know how to make decisions.
Yeah.
Murphy comes out in the middle of this argument saying, look what Pete Rose made for me. It's a personalized DC license plate. And she cackles appreciatively and then goes back into her office.
Now, I originally, when I watched this, went, oh, Pete Rose was in jail for betting. And then I looked it up and it was like, no, actually, it was tax evasion. He was kicked out of baseball for betting.
Yep.
So that one surprised me. I had not remembered that. Pete Rose was the manager of the Reds. He also was a baseball player himself. And this is a very timely joke. There's a couple of timely jokes in this.
Oh, there's some timely jokes. And now that she's left, they ask, so what did Frank get her? And he said he's amazed even himself this year.
Yeah.
He'd racked his brains for months. What do you get for the person who has everything?
Really,
right? And then it came to him. A sister. Corky, my other favorite line. A nun. It was so good. It was so good.
That's one of the lines I wrote down. Yeah.
It's incredible. And he says, no, like a sibling. She's an only child and said to Frank once that she's always wondered what it would have been like to have siblings. So he went to New York and hired an actress to be her sister from noon till midnight that day. Corky is correct and cries out, this is the stupidest gift she's ever heard of.
It is.
He doesn't know what to buy for women. I was going to say something when you bought me that wiffle ball set for my birthday, but now you've gone too far.
We've now discovered they've all bought selfish gifts. Now, before we go into this, I'm going to quickly ask you a question.
Yeah.
Is this a gift that you think is a good gift?
I think I'm torn because I have the hindsight of how it eventually turns out.
Fair.
You know, I'm torn because I know that it becomes a positive in the end.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is the most interesting about it is that it came out of Murphy pre-rehab.
Yeah, right?
I'm curious about if it's a good present for Murphy now or if it was a good present for Murphy then.
Well, that's a really good question. Now, emotionally, maybe a different answer from, is she ready to accept this kind of gift now because she is sober and awake to appreciate it eventually, right? To absorb it and remember it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Murphy before would have played along more.
Mm.
I feel like Murphy now is the one who would actually get the lesson she does later.
So my thought is in two parts. One is what I thought originally when I watched it as a kid is this is such a thoughtful, creative gift which shows how much Frank cares about Murphy.
Exactly.
Right? But on the surface, looking at it now from if I was really in this situation and my best friend made me spend the whole day of my birthday with a stranger, I would be just as mad as Murphy.
I feel like from the heart of where Frank is coming from, it's incredibly thoughtful and it really ends up paying off.
It does, yeah.
It is such a I know my friend. It is the one thing that we see that someone gives someone that is entirely about the other person. Like this is entirely about Murphy's deepest wish that she said in a drunken haze, filling this part of her. Like he really knows his friend. So like that source of it, I think, is the most insightful of any of the gifts that we hear of.
Absolutely.
In this episode. But I will say the way it plays out feels like it's more a prank than a gift.
Yeah.
Which, again, I think this is why I'm like Murphy before probably would have just played along with the prank and been very surface about it. I think she probably would have played along more, gotten drunk with her at Phil's.
Yeah.
And had this, you know, this big, like,
she can just drink.
Not dealing with it. But now she has to deal with what makes her uncomfortable because she can't drink her way away. So it's not as fun for her. But I think it ends up being more rewarding at the end of it.
Yeah, which is the example of most experiences for Murphy she doesn't want to do. Mm-hmm. She gets pushed into it. And then learn something at the end.
Yep.
And this is such a great example of that because Murphy doesn't have a lot of female friends.
Yep.
And we've talked about that female friendship is very important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, friendship in general. I don't want this to seem like this is like a sexist thing, right? But just there's, let me talk about it this way. It's not even just female friendship. It's friendship with someone who comes from your experience.
Yeah, a true contemporary.
Is an experience that Frank can't relate to.
Exactly. I think we look at like the women that we see in Murphy's life and they're either older than her, like her mother and Doris, or they're younger than her, like Corky, or they're her direct competitors. And so the idea of having someone with the same identity as you who's doesn't feel like a competitor or someone who's either above or below in rank, But I think it ends up being an excellent gift for her.
It does. Yes, it does. Yes. But in the reality of the moment, I would be just as mad as she was.
I would be livid. I'd be like, where's everybody else? Like, yeah. Nope, we're just leaving you with this person. I'm like, I wanted to hang out with my friends.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm also very surprised that Murphy, being Murphy, doesn't have a huge bash planned in the evening. That she only has this 4 p.m. cake and merriment stuff, and she doesn't have, like, a dinner party or something with a musical guest.
No, but she says that she... that Frank told her to keep the whole day open. She thinks that Frank has planned something. It could be a surprise party.
I'm just shocked that she didn't ignore.
Oh, ignore. Oh, well, I guess it shows how much that she trusts him, which is even the worst part. She trusted him. And he
was. Yeah, she really thinks that he's giving her the thing she would have planned for herself.
Yeah, right? Yeah, absolutely. He has a lot of money.
His response to Corky is that, no, Murphy's going to love it. This actress has been researching everything of Murphy's life. The only thing is that they need Murphy to loosen up and get into it. So if they want it to be the best day she's ever had, they'll play along. And Murphy re-enters saying she can't believe it, the bush is stifter again. Miles tries to give her the group gift. And I love she just walks by brushing him off to go put it with all the other gifts. And he just stands there kind of miffed holding the box.
Yeah, yeah.
Murphy begs Frank to just give her one hint. Is it animal, vegetable, or four-wheel drive with Italian leather interior? And he says it's something she's never had, she's always wondered about, and she'll find out what it is at noon sharp, when they're at Phil's. And Miles jumps in with, and we'll bring this to Phil's too, and he shoves the box in Murphy's face, and then just sits there for a second and says, feel, too heavy to be a toaster. And I have to know how many versions of whatever that is Grant tried. Because I feel like that was potentially an ad-lib.
It's very Grant. And it's...
Yeah.
So we're at Phil's. It's 12. Murphy is just like, bated breath. Where's her gift? She wants it now. She's...
I mean, technically, I feel like it's 11:58.
Probably. You're right. You're right. 12. It's probably 11:58. Yes, yes, yes. But until then, at Phil's, at the hero table, Murphy is going to open up the gift that Miles is so excited about because she says it's from three people with very large salaries who chipped in to buy this for me.
Yep.
And what I love is the fact that Murphy finds out what it is. She assumes it's a gag gift.
Yeah. Yep.
Even when she opens it, she is like tearing it apart, like looking through everything, throwing all the sort of, you know, packaging, looking for the real gift as Miles sort of, you know, explains what the gift is because he's so excited about it. And I love the fact that it's such a child thing to do, like not even to pretend, be like, no, this can't be it. This can't be my gift.
Yeah. Because who would buy that for her? I mean, she is a prankster. So she does anticipate that people are going to try and prank her.
Yeah, exactly.
And coming from a family where my dad did the thing of buying you like a set of earrings and then putting it in like a Russian nesting doll of like seven different boxes.
Oh, that's great.
I would jump to that.
That's so great, Jesse. Oh, I love that. Yeah.
So I feel like she's like, well, obviously you're pranking me, you tricksters. What did you really get me?
See, like, I didn't have Christmas, obviously, and so my parents made our birthdays kind of what I hear people tell stories about Christmas. So, like, I would wake up in the morning and all my presents would be in my room.
Incredible.
Including a pink BMX bike.
Oh, that's so cool.
So as this is happening, this fabulous redhead in this fabulous salmon jacket, the costumes this season, we know that they win the Emmy this year, but, like, the way that they dress... Christine Ebersole, who we know we're about to talk about, with this sort of teal jacket underneath and the white. And we know that this is probably the actress because she kind of signals Frank that she's ready. And then Frank is, you know, all excited to present his gift. He said, what would a birthday be without family? All the way from your hometown of Philadelphia, your sister, Maddie Brown. This woman turns around with the biggest enthusiasm and yells, stinky! Again, great presentation. But if I were Murphy and Frank did not explain it, I would have been so confused.
So, like, that's like, I just would have been so confused.
So confused. Particularly, the woman hugs Murphy and Murphy says, why is a woman I don't know hugging me? Maddie then introduces herself to everyone sitting at the table. I'm Murphy's sister. Now, I have decided that it's going to be very hard to tell everybody what Maddie says because of the delivery of Christine Ebersole and also because she talks so fast. Yes. None of us will do it justice, but just know that
A breath to be found.
Yes. This is a theater trained actress as well, which Jesse will talk about. Mm-hmm. But I've been a fan of hers forever, but as I'm sure we both are, I love characters in sitcoms who do this. who are very sort of perky and talk really fast. It's so hard. There's an art to it. And she just brings so much to this character as a over-the-top actor, as herself, and as Murphy's quote-unquote sister, right? We never learn her real name.
Yeah.
And so just know that she is a ball of energy, which would be probably the opposite of Murphy.
It's such a big performance, but it's one of my favorite examples of one of my instructors always talked about that it's not that you minimize your performance when you go from stage to screen, but you minimize the container that you're in.
There you
go. So how does that performance fit your container? Mm-hmm. This is a huge comedic theatrical performance, but it fits within the container of television in such an excellent way. But it's still, you get the idea, it's not that it's too big for television, it's that it's a big character for these people. Like, she is too big for the room because she's doing this performance, not because she's a theater person in a television show, if that makes sense.
It fits into the character because you would believe that she's trying too hard.
Yeah, you believe she's this theater actress trying to play the part of a lifetime. And there's this, like, God, I hope I get it energy to her throughout the entire thing. It's incredible.
Would you like to talk about Miss Christine Ebersole right now?
Would I love to talk about Christine Ebersole?
Let's talk right about now. Christine Ebersole.
So Christine Ebersole is one of those icons of stage and screen that again, looking back in retrospect, I feel like what I knew her first from as a child is not what I know her best from as an adult.
I don't even know what I knew her from first.
And I'm pretty sure the first thing I saw her in was My Girl 2.
That tracks, yeah.
And then the next year she was the mom in Richie Rich. So I feel like I saw her back to back in these two things. And that's where my recognition of her face and her voice comes from. But y'all, we could talk forever about Christine Ebersole. We won't, because we have more episode to talk about. But fun fact, she was born in Winnetka, Illinois, just north of Chicago proper, very near where I live right now. She met Mark Shaman, famous Mark Shaman, when he was 19 and the musical director of her first club act.
Do you want to remind people who Mark Shaman is?
Do you want to remind people who Mark
I
Shaman
do.
Is?
I do. Mark Shaman from my hometown, which if you've listened to our show, you know that. But also, we've mentioned Mark because Mark did all the music for Sister Act. Mark wrote Hairspray, which we just mentioned in this episode. Mark is a genius. Yes. Mark left high school when he was 15 and then was working for Bette Midler within a year. He is a genius. A prodigy, really, is probably the better thing. He's written Broadway musicals. He did the music to Misery, A Few Good Men, and did a lot of cabaret stuff. And he's a jack of all trades, really.
Incredible. So some of her big breaks were she had two different roles in two different seasons of Ryan's Hope, but but if you listen to our Patreon, we talked about Candace's history with SNL. And at one point we reference the brief time in which SNL was produced by a different person. Christine Ebersole was a cast member of that time, 1981 to 1982 season, the first full season under new producer Dick Ebersole, not related.
Yeah, that was always so funny. Not related at all.
Her comedy chops are strong. One of my favorite things about her as a television performer is that this was in 1991. In 1996, she stars in the single season of Diane English's Inc. TV show.
Yeah, she remembered her.
Starring Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen. I now know Christine Ebersole best as the stage performer. I mean, her history on stage is huge. But in particular, she has won two Tony Awards. She won in 2001 for the 42nd Street Revival, and then in 2007 for Grey Gardens, where she played the dual role of Big and Little Edie.
She was amazing in that. I got to see it for my
birthday.
Insane. Yeah.
Insanely good. I got to see her in 2009 when she was in the revival of Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit with Angela Lansbury.
Oh my God, that's right. I did see her in that too.
She was so good. She's so good. It was one of my favorite things I've seen her do. But another one that I got to see in New York was her in War Paint.
I saw War Paint also.
The musical. Yes, I did too. I got to see War Paint while I was still living in New York. It was before I moved. But the musical focuses on the lives and rivalry between 20th century female entrepreneurs Elizabeth Arden and Helena Rubinstein. Starring Christine Ebersole as Elizabeth Arden and one Patti LuPone as Helena Rubinstein. To hold your own in a dual starring role with Patti LuPone says a lot about Christine Ebersole's like force of nature and craft. She's incredible. She's funny. She's deep. She has this huge voice, but she can also play these smaller, more gentler women. Though I do have to remind everyone, she's 5'10". So like the woman commands a space.
I did not realize that. Wow.
She's currently, I believe it's still going,
yeah.
Bob Hart's Abishola.
She is, yeah.
It's a sitcom that started in 2019. She's one of those people that, like, her performances have not aged at all. Like, she's still as vibrant and as snappy and as interesting to watch
yeah.
as she was when she was younger. So highly recommend. She's in everything. She's yeah. so good.
She's in Amadeus and Tootsie.
Uh-huh. Yeah, oh, right. She's in
Three
Tootsie.
Men and a Baby. Like, what I really find fascinating about her career is how she started out in the theater and had a couple of Broadway performances, obviously did Cabaret with Mark, mm-hmm. and then moves to L.A., I assume, because she starts doing all of these. She had her own sitcom for a year,
yeah.
Rachel Gunn, which I remember watching because yeah. I was like, oh, I like her.
I was and, like, she's great.
Yeah, and then racking up all of this sort of television and movie. I know Amadeus, mm-hmm. she got a lot of attention for that. And then yep. coming back to Broadway in like the 2000s, doing 42nd Street, winning the Tony, and then having this like amazing theater career as if, yeah. you know, she'd always been this sort of Patti LuPone kind of a diva. And I don't mm-hmm. know as much about her career beforehand, so I may be wrong, but it always sort of reminded me of like Stalker Channing.
Yeah
you,
yeah.
you go to LA, you get the recognition and the name, and then you can come back and do all this really great theater work that maybe you weren't able to do before. Name recognition. Yeah. I love her mm-hmm. Tessitura in the Bette Midler version of Gypsy.
I was going to say the yeah. Bette Midler version of Gypsy is one of my strong visual memories of her.
Yeah, Royal Pains, tons of stuff. She's a consummate stage and television performer, and just particularly mm-hmm. sitcom, I think she's so good at. So this is, mm-hmm. I think this role, anyone else, it wouldn't be something that you remember.
This just ties into a quote from Corby Siamis about Tom Palmer's writing and how this episode is another example of Tom's greatness with creating fun outside characters. To meet the level that is written by Tom, you have to get an actor who can carry it, because he writes these really interesting characters that just come bursting into an established group and have to hold their own. And it takes someone like Christine Ebersole to do it.
Yeah, I had asked Tom if he remembered anything from the episode, and it was a long time ago, so he emailed back that he really didn't remember a lot. But he thinks that this was offer only. And so I think it's interesting that she was a name among the industry enough for them to like probably be given a list of actors to go, oh, yeah her.
Mm-hmm.
So as all this is going on, Miles is trying to take his blood pressure.
Again, because he didn't buy it for someone who would want to be bought
it for himself. Yes. And Frank is encouraging everyone to like accept the fact that this is Murphy's fake sister, and they all know that. And Jim comments that they have the same eyebrows. Like, he's just like, I'm not good at this. I don't know what to do.
He's like, yeah, totally.
And Murphy starts to become sort of impressed at what at first just feels like a parlor trick, right? Like, it's just something that's going to last for like maybe, you know, 30 minutes and then it'll be done. So at first she's like, wow, this person is really good. They remember that in their childhood, their father built Murphy a treehouse in the backyard for her 10th birthday, that Mark Beekman hit Murphy in the face with a 7-Up bottle and she got 17 stitches. And apparently that was something that happened to Tom. He said that someone threw a bottle and like messed his teeth up or something. He couldn't remember a lot of it, but you know, he said that was something from his real life. So Murphy starts to test her. What happened in the treehouse on July 4th, 1959? And that was the day they came up with their secret handshake. And then she knows the handshake. Obviously she did a lot of research. Murphy does it wrong to mess her up. And she corrects her. And again, Murphy is just like so impressed, like, wow, like this is really cool. And then Phil comes over and he overdoes a whole thing about family, which, you know, is too much, which he wishes her a happy birthday and then she'll get a complimentary salad with her lunch.
I also have to ask, how do you think she got most of this information in a non-internet time?
That's the thing.
I mean, we know that, I assume she's talked to Avery based on later.
Yes. I think that Frank has provided her with probably a dossier, right?
Uh-huh.
But the fact that I think that to make this believable, they added in that line in the other scene where Frank is like, she's mm-hmm. been doing research.
Exactly. I'm like, but how was she doing the research, Frank?
I think that she went down to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
She expensed it to Frank.
Yep.
And she interviewed like everyone mm-hmm. that Murphy went to high school with, all of her friends. I mean, because I can't imagine that Murphy told Frank about the secret handshake.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, it doesn't take me out of the episode at all. I'm not saying that. I'm just like, I want a side plot where we watch
Maddie,
because we don't know her real name, researching, because it's hilarious to me. how she would have found this stuff.
And and I also believe it because she's so desperate to not lose another acting job.
Yes, she's such a good actor. She's showing how much work she puts into it. Like, she has a craft, and she is dedicated.
She is so dedicated. Just as it's about to wear off, everyone says goodbye, and Murphy is confused. Why is everybody going? And Frank's like, you won't believe it. You have Maddie until midnight. And that's when I'm just like, Frank, no. Your birthday alone with a stranger.
Awful. Awful.
As they're leaving, Miles asks Jim if his blood pressure 200 over 102 is good. And Jim says, there's justice in this world after all. Maddie thinks that Frank is cute.
Uh-huh.
She's trying to make, like, a girl, I think, sisterly conversation, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Murphy is like, thank you so much. You know, you'll still be paid. You can go. It doesn't matter. The novelty is worn off for her. She has a very short attention span. And this really upsets Maddie. She says it's happening again. She's been fired from every single acting job she's ever had. Oh, wow.
Maddie.
What could she have done?
That's where I'm like, she seems competent.
I mean,
I wonder if she's too intense about her parts.
She'll be anything that Murphy wants. She'll be, you know, she doesn't have to be her younger sister to make her feel old. She can be her illegitimate sister. She can have an accent like mom and dad send her away to some English boarding school, and she has an effective speech. And she goes, oh, Murphy, why don't we take the ponies out for a ride?
It's so good.
You know, she's just so desperate. She could be Murphy's older sister. She's really good at this. I think that she's really good. She's just trying too hard. And Murphy is miserable as they leave Phil's.
And we cut to the bullpen. We're back. Murphy enters and she's still miserable because Maddie is still talking.
Yes.
You could tell she has not stopped talking. They make their way into the center. Maddie says she never understood why Murphy was in such a hurry to grow up. She'll never forget her raiding mother's liquor cabinet on her sweet 16th birthday. She still thinks that's where her problem started.
Oh, she's going deep.
Oh, and Murphy just looks out and says the most pitiful, Frank. Maddie says hello to the room. And that's when Carl makes his way over, introduces himself. He didn't know that Murphy had a sister. And Maddie very sweetly asks him what he does. And Carl is shocked.
Oh, he's so
upset. Murphy hadn't told her about him by now. Sweet Carl. And Murphy just miserably says, she and I aren't very close, Carl. Frank arrives and she takes that opportunity to pull Frank into the office alone. And we finally get to see how chaotic her office is at this time. And it is just wrapped and unwrapped gifts galore. There's a giant pig plushie on top of the desk.
There's a Reagan cutout of him as a cowboy in his movie days with a bow on it.
It's incredible.
Like, I feel like every time I would watch the episode, I would notice something new in the room.
Yes. I also have to say, I know this is a little later in the scene, but we finally see the dartboard.
Yes, we do.
Unleaded $1.69.
You know, I thought we'd had this sign before, and I can't.
We had something about gas prices. It was literally the word gas prices.
Maybe, yeah, but I looked in our database and, like, of all of our past breakdowns, and I couldn't find it, but I felt like it was similar.
While Murphy's talking to Frank, she's lifting and cleaning gifts off of her desk to get back to the desk itself. And she says, okay, it was very clever. They all had a good laugh, but she doesn't want that woman following her around until midnight, which, fair.
Yes.
Frank is genuinely surprised. He says he thought a sister would be the greatest gift he could ever get her. She was so passionate about it that night. Murphy says, that night? What night? And he says they were closing up Phil's. They were talking about family and his sisters. And then she started sobbing uncontrollably about not having any sisters. Doesn't she remember? And Murphy turns and says, I was drinking then, Frank. I said a lot of things I didn't mean. I probably said I wanted to sleep with Larry Storch, too, but you didn't give me him for my birthday.
So apparently Larry Storch, who was on F Troop, which you don't have to look up. I only know it from commercials from TV Land when I was a kid, was on in the 60s, a sitcom about guns and cowboys and stuff. And apparently Larry Storch wrote Diane a letter. And it was, I think, a little tongue in cheek, you know, so I don't think he was, like, mad necessarily, you know, but he did say that now people knew who he was and he could get reservations at restaurants, which I think is kind of like a fun way to be like, I'm laughing with you. Thanks for the mention. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Even though it's not positive.
It gets a really good laugh.
Yeah,
so
it does.
It
yeah.
He says, listen to herself. Can't she just forget she's a reporter who brokers all day long in reality and just let herself experience something she's never known for one day? He says, cut yourself loose. What do you say? And at this point, she has made her way around to kind of downstage, and she's holding one of the gifts that she has picked up from her desk. It is a red crowbar with a yellow bow on it, and she uses that to gesture that she's gonna get him. I love this. He says, "What a sad, sad statement." And he says, "Well, I am not calling her off." And he goes to leave. That's when we see the dartboard. And he turns around and says, "You know the rule. Fontana gifts are unreturnable." And he marches out, I assume back to his office. And she comes out wielding the gift crowbar, saying they're unreturnable because he can't shop in a store like a normal human being. "You're a sick person, Frank." Incredible. The crowbar is a paid extra. At that moment, Carl turns, you know, returns to her and says her sister went to the ladies' room, if she's wondering where she is. And Murphy turns to the full bullpen and says to everyone that she is going to be in editing for the rest of the day. "When my sister comes back, don't tell her where I am and don't let her in my office. I don't want to see her again for the rest of my lifetime. You got that?" And she rushes into the elevator that has just opened. And Carl turns downstage and takes his hat off in distress and leans on the desk and says, "Dear God, why won't that woman let someone love her?"
That is a great out.
It's...
That is such a great scene out. It's so perfect.
It's so good.
And then we are...
Sweet Carl.
Sweet Carl. And now we're in the townhouse. Murphy comes in with like a sad little bag of Chinese food. She's so upset. She's complaining to Eldon, you know, that she turned down so many birthday invites because Frank asked her to keep the day open. It's his fault that she's spending her birthday eating fortune cookies and not eating birthday cake with Al Pacino.
I mean... Fair.
Yeah. And then Eldon acts like a married couple. "Whatever happened to honey, I'm home. You didn't call. I didn't know when to put in the cacciatore." And Murphy kind of like, her eyes light up and she's like, "Chicken cacciatore? It's like her favorite. Like someone actually cared." But it's not Eldon. It's Maddie, who comes in with the food and a whole bunch of party favors, singing 16 tons. Because as we mentioned,
incredible
double Tony Award winning experience, getting her to sing. I mean, she gets applause.
I mean, it's incredible. Like she's doing it like a joke, but it is also so well done.
It's like, that last
her
note.
Her voice is huge. It's incredible.
The last note. It's like all funny. And then she holds this last note and it's like, oh, this is the professional.
Like, oh, right. This is what we got.
So this song goes back all the way to the 40s. Known mostly sung by Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Dang, really?
Yeah, I mean, surprised at that.
I guess I could hear that.
Yeah, but Tennessee Ernie Ford recorded it in 55. A lot of people recorded it. It just was the most popular version of it, one that people mostly have heard. Like, most recently, the song is on the soundtrack of Asteroid City by Wes Anderson. So people are still hearing it.
I was like, wait a second, yeah.
But just to give people a little sort of history, that this is a song that for the 20th century, or even more, from like 1955 all the way to, you know, now, this song is still out in the zeitgeist. I think I first heard it in the opening of Joe Versus the Volcano.
Oh, good call.
It's also a union song. It's about miners. So pretty much as Eldon, you know, is convinced that this is Murphy's sister, and she says, "It's not my sister," and he goes, "Ah, she said you'd say that," as if like this is a game that they play. But when she goes in the other room, Eldon does sit down and is like, what do you mean she's not your sister? Like he definitely knows it may not be like a thing. Like he gets that she's serious, which I think shows their relationship, right? Murphy's mother calls and she thinks it's to, you know, wish her a happy birthday. But there's other things that Avery is calling about. She wants to speak to her daughter. And that really pisses Murphy off. "You don't have another daughter. You have way too much time on your hands." After she gets off the phone, Maddie is just like, oh, she wants us to come for Christmas. The other thing that Eldon comments is that unlike Murphy, Maddie walked into the kitchen and recognized it immediately. Now, the food smells really good. And I have to say, I looked up Kitchen Cacciatore and it does sound like it would be really good and it would smell really amazing. I love a good chicken dish. So Murphy decides that they'll eat and then she has to go.
Yes.
And then the outline for this, which is also great, is which gets a huge laugh, is Eldon says to Maddie, "Man, you must have cried the day they brought that home from the hospital."
So we have a quick time jump and we see that they are finalizing the meal. Murphy is, her mouth is full and she's speaking through a full mouth saying they better speed it up. Gandhi didn't eat as slow as they do. And Maddie turns to Eldon and says, "Oh, Murphy's always been a slow eater. They were always told never to touch her while she's eating." And Murphy just from her mouth is like, "My father never said that." I mean, it seems like maybe it hit a little too close to home with the way that she snaps about that. I'm just saying. Eldon, ever the
the man to fall in love says that the dinner was excellent and Maddie is very charming. You know, he was recently hurt by a woman.
Oh, Elton.
He could do worse. Murphy at that moment interrupts him by standing up saying, she's done, dinner's over, and you know what that means. Maddie stands up and says, dessert! She's standing outside the kitchen door and Eldon leans in, wanting to know if maybe he was being too obvious when he said he could furnish her with a complete medical history. Which means we finally get to go in the kitchen. One yes. of my favorite sets of Murphy Brown.
And something that Jesse and I talked about off mic, and I will put these pictures side by side on the Instagram, but anyone who watched the revival, there was a scene in the kitchen. And I have to say, you know, there's no proof that they had access to what the kitchen used to look like, and most likely they didn't. But I hope that maybe they did, because barring like a window for a door, which if someone had their kitchen remodeled could become a thing, the kitchen in the revival looks very similar to the kitchen in the original series, and I really appreciate that.
Kudos to them for doing the research on the kitchen as well. You know, we start the series with her having her kitchen painted. We're supposed to have her kitchen painted. You know, she got it remodeled. It would make sense that over time, if there's one area of your house that's probably going to need the most updating over the amount of time that we see span, is probably going to be your kitchen.
So speaking of Murphy's kitchen.
Yes.
We have found something that I have never noticed. And it's funny because it's not like we have really clean copies. I mean, they're pretty clean.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. But I think it's because I watched it a second time on my phone. So it was like right up in my face.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because otherwise, like, the screen is full of so much wonderful, I think, scene design interest.
Yeah. Would you like to tell the audience what we discovered?
I mean, you did discover it, so I feel like you should tell us. No, I'm so proud of you. I want you to take all the credit.
Oh, thank you. Little archaeologist. So above the window in Murphy's kitchen is a sign, much like a modern live, laugh, and love.
Indeed. Like, beautiful, I would say, typeface, a nice script. It gives you the feeling of an inviting, motivational message, yes. A mantra for the room.
Very, very white lady kitchen aesthetic.
Indeed.
But with a Murphy twist, the sign says, do unto others before they do it to you. Which I feel can be taken two ways. Don't you think?
I do believe. I think there are multiple reads of this sign.
Because there's, aw, be kind to others. Or, aw, get them before they get you.
I firmly believe the only reason it was purchased was the get them before they get you.
Absolutely.
And I think she allows people who want to believe the best in her to read it the other way.
I also wonder if this was a gift from, like, Frank.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Frank would have absolutely bought that.
Yay. Set design.
So we see Maddie and she's at the fridge and Murphy walks in saying, it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your airplane is?
Which for people who may not know, I feel like it's on TikTok a lot and Instagram, mm-hmm. but there used to be a PSA in the 90s and maybe even in the 80s that mm-hmm. said, it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? Which was just about kidnapping and stuff.
And the life of the latchkey kid. Have you seen the videos that'll come out about the PSA that was about being nice to your kids?
No. Oh, my God.
I think it's from the 80s. And it's just this, like, montage of kids, you know, dropping things or having a bad grade and the parent snapping at them. And the PSA is literally like, have you considered being gentle with your child? Maybe what they need is, like, it's literally telling our parents to be nice to us. What a time. They had to be reminded to hug us to maybe check and make sure we were home at 10. Like, what a time. What a time to be alive. Maddie is at the fridge, as we said, and she is insisting. Now, this is where we start seeing some of the best choices that Christine Ebersole makes, which Maddie has this manic, like, desperation in her eyes, but she's holding it together. But you can just see in her eyes that she's starting to lose it, that the stakes are high.
But then at one point, like when she talks about the Beatles, her voice goes really high.
Oh my God, she's so good. Like, you can just feel the tension in her. And she says, well, dessert is part of dinner and she won't hear anything about it. They're going to make brownies just like they did the day Paul left the Beatles. And she glides over to the counter and her eyes, I wrote, her eyes are so desperate. They're enormous. But also, like, it's that great thing that her entire body is gliding and controlled, but her eyes, you just know it's not okay. Murphy approaches her and says she has tried to be nice. She's going to bring out the artillery. If Maddie doesn't leave in 3 minutes, she's going to physically throw her out.
Can we also talk about that, like, the entire island is just filled with food and a mess? And I really love that detail. I mean, obviously she was cooking, but, like, it just sort of shows, like, if she just gets it to midnight, then she didn't get fired from the job.
Exactly. I also think that it's just so funny and sad that that's probably the most action that island has seen in years. Yes. Like, it's just the island's probably so happy to be used.
I mean, the best joke in the revival is when they open up the oven and the instructions are still inside.
Yep. It's just, that, like, kitchen's like, killer joke. Yay.
Killer joke.
Yay, a friend is here. So in response to this, Maddie sighs and takes off the party hat and says, okay, you win. I'll go. It's obvious I can't make this work for you. Mm-hmm. Kudos. It's not resentful. It's not petulant. And it's what softens Murphy, because she just seems so disappointed and sad. Murphy softens and says, look, all this food is yours. Why don't you take it with you? Maddie's not leaving anytime soon because Maddie's going through it. And just says, boy, it's just staring me in the face, isn't it? Actress. Ugh. Who am I kidding? Murphy's like, nope. Okay, so why don't you start wrapping while you're having these feelings? She's trying to get her to help her wrap things up. And Maddie, nope, Maddie's about to process. So she says, deep down inside, I guess I've always known my limitations. And she says she hasn't had much success as an actress. Maddie starts describing a commercial. And what's really funny about this, she describes this commercial and my brain was positive I'd seen it before. I think I was thinking of the California Raisins.
I think, yeah, I think so.
Maybe it's because this scene was so evocative to me as a young person watching it that I conflated the two.
Murphy asked the same question. Were you in there?
Yeah. She describes this commercial where peanuts are marching into a peanut butter jar. One peanut refuses to jump in because she doesn't think she's up to their standards. And Murphy pauses in her, you know, that peanut was you? Maddie looks sad at the question, says, no, that's how I feel about my career. She says what makes it all sink in is seeing where Murphy is in life. Famous, successful, respected. And that's a moment where Murphy finally kind of stops trying to hustle her out and says, you know, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And this little opening allows Maddie to keep going. She says, ever since she was little, she dreamed of being a great actress. She'd dress up as Katharine Hepburn, her dog was Spencer Tracy, and act out Adam's Rib. And Murphy laughs. And this is when she finally stops entirely and she comes down and she's kind of chuckling to herself. And she says, and Maddie, you know, wonders why she's laughing. And she says, well, she used to pretend the strainer was a microphone and make the kid next door be Nixon. And then she'd nail him after the checker speech. To which Maddie goes, I know. Because Maddie did her research.
That's so funny. I didn't see it that way. And I love that you see it that way. And it makes much more sense. Because the way that I saw it was that she just said that to still be in character.
Oh, no, I 100% was like, she knows because she probably went to the neighbor's house and asked them about Murphy growing up. And they were like, oh, she terrorized my son and made him be Nixon. And Maddie says the difference is Murphy made it and she didn't. Murphy comes over and she says one of my favorite little speeches that she has. She says, after I got out of college, I thought I was going to be the greatest broadcast journalist of my generation. I had this audition tape and I begged a friend to get it to Howard K. Smith. To me, he was the best. What broadcast journalism was all about. I wanted to be Howard K. Smith in a dress. Which I love because we always talk about how Murphy was referred to as Mike Wallace in a dress. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, was that intentional? She says, so I waited and waited for a response. A month, 6 weeks, nothing. Finally, I called my friend and he told me, in fact, Howard K. had seen my tape. And she takes in this breath and she says, his only comment was, her work stinks, but she's got a nice tush. And my heart just
this whole
dropped.
Scene is lovely. And I want to add that apparently Howard K. Smith's secretary, former assistant secretary, sent a letter to Diane upset about that line because she said that he would never do it. And it's like
he would never have done that.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, I see that if, you know, you didn't. Yeah. But it's you know, it's fictional. Right. You know,
it's fiction. But yeah, that was like it's that I can see someone who was close to him and probably wants to defend him being like, the fiction is predicated upon assuming that he would have that character.
Exactly, yeah.
And so I can see why I didn't take it that way. I took it as fiction, but I can see why someone who was close to and cared about his legacy would be concerned.
So I thought it was interesting to bring up. Remember in the episode with Jim's laugh, there was an anchor, but we couldn't figure out who it was.
Oh, you think that's Howard K. Smith?
I think it's Howard K. Smith. And I did look at some pictures, and I'm a little unsure, but I'm wondering if it is.
I'd believe that.
Yeah. It's part of me is like, yeah, and then part of me is like, oh, I don't know. It doesn't kind of look like him, but it kind of does. But yeah, we'll find out when.
Go there.
Yeah, we'll find out when this drops, because one of the writers will email us and tell us who Howard K. Smith was.
I can't wait. Please solve the mystery.
Sorry. I mean, I know who Howard K. Smith is. I mean, who the guy in the photo was. I know how to Google.
I'm aware of Howard K. Smith and his legacy. For me, I'm not aware of him enough to have recognized a photo of him.
Exactly.
If it was him.
We are too young. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And also, because this episode is so jam-packed, we don't have time to talk about him, but perhaps in a later episode we will.
At this little break in her speech, she does one of my favorite things that people do in the world, which is she cracks an egg with one hand into the brownie batter. My dad grew up in a diner. My entire life, he always would crack eggs on the counter and just drop them in without shell or anything like that, because it was a skill.
That was very impressive to me.
I had to stop as an audience member and just admire Candace Bergen for pulling off the egg crack in the scene in such a good take. Like, the stress of like trying to get that, if you're not, that isn't something you can just do while doing this like meaningful scene and then just punctuate it with that. Incredible.
Yeah. There is something about, you know, when you're having sort of a moment like that and the business that you do, mm-hmm. and how it reflects on your mood. And it's always more interesting to me than someone just standing still and giving mm-hmm. like a monologue, is like the actions that they do and the business that they do.
Yeah. Well, because in real life, especially when we're being vulnerable with someone new, or if we're not used to being vulnerable, we don't sit still.
We don't.
She says, "Felt like someone had hit me in the face with a brick. My idol was telling me I couldn't cut it as a journalist. The only other thing I knew how to do was lip sync to records. And back then it wasn't a real profession like it is now."
You know what I realized? No one, I don't think people get that joke anymore.
Yeah. I can see that.
But there's going to be a movie soon. And so I feel like it's an interesting part of history. So very briefly, that's a Milli Vanilli joke.
Yep. Yep.
For people not familiar with Milli Vanilli, they were a German R&B act who won a Grammy, had a bunch of big hits, to find out that the people that we knew as the band were lip syncing to someone else's track. And they had been pretending. And so their Grammy was taken back. It was a really big thing. And so that is what Murphy is referencing.
So Murphy starts stirring the batter as she's finishing talking. And what I love is that Maddie, and I think actually this is one of those great moments when it's Christine instinctively mm-hmm. in this role as Maddie, leans forward to hold the bowl for her while she's stirring. And just kind of like, it's a lean in physically and literally into the conversation, but it's also what you would do if someone was stirring and the bowl could slide. Like, she's just automatically helping like a sister would. It's so sweet and small, but the stirring and Maddie leaning forward to help just creates such a beautiful moment of connection that is the unspoken undercurrent. It's just a beautiful scene.
It's gorgeous.
And Murphy says, "I guess what I'm trying to say is, no matter what it is you want to do, you've got to go after it. No matter what other people say about you, it's always going to be hard, no matter if you're 21 or 42. Oh, God, I'm 42. And then Maddie, in the compliment that I think we all grow tired of hearing eventually, which is, "Oh, that's okay. You look really good."
It's very sweet.
Which kind of thinks to herself and then shares that she's never told anyone that story.
Really?
Yeah, I guess it's really the kind of thing you only tell. And they smile in unison. And Maddie goes, "A sister?" "Yeah, a sister." And then Murphy launches in and she starts going, "You know, I had this other experience when I was a correspondent in London." And I love it. Maddie's like, "Oh, I've never been to London. I've always said I'd get there. What happened?" And the camera pulls back and fades out on the two of them working on the batter together and chatting and telling stories that you only tell a sister. Okay, so one, yay, so sweet. And two, Maddie did it. She finished her job.
She did.
I'm so proud of her.
Can I just imagine that, like, you know, they kept in touch and she still sends Murphy postcards about the showcase that she's going to be in the
She
village.
Invites her to everything.
Everything.
This, like, sweet, corny part for me is the Maddie started this creating this fictional history and stories with Murphy. And when she finishes the job, she leaves with actual stories and experiences with Murphy that only the two of them have. I think it's just really lovely.
It's in the end, it's two women, whether they're related or not, mm-hmm. having the experience that Murphy told Frank she always wanted.
Mm-hmm. Frank actually did good.
He really did good, you know, and in spite of him. And I think we talked about at the beginning, you know, it's Murphy doesn't have a lot of female friends on the show. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's just a connection that you have with another woman that is different than a male friendship.
It's just really beautiful. I think the layers to the way this is written, with the familial connection, the generational connection, I love the conversation about, like, it's always going to be hard no matter if you're 21 or 42. Like, the grass is greener concept and the way that we always think someone else has it figured out when imposter syndrome is forever. I love this episode so much. I think it's one of my favorite guest star moments. I think it's one of my favorite looks into Murphy that's new that we have. This is a side of Murphy, an element to Murphy that is not kind of a newly packaged version of something we've already seen before because of this unique relationship.
Another episode that I'm sad to see go.
I know. But another episode I cannot wait to make someone else watch with me so that I can watch them watch it.
There's so many episodes of this show where I feel like you can go, oh, this showcases a great guest star.
Yes.
I think this is the kind of show that made me really just love the whole guest star genre. So we've previously talked at the beginning of season three, as we are in, that this is kind of the season where, coming off of the Emmy win, Murphy Brown really started to become what would be known as a ratings hit. Mm-hmm. Not that it wasn't slowly getting better, but, you know, the Emmys really sort of showed people that it might be a show that they should tune into. What I'm going to focus on today is not just the fact that the ratings were getting better, but something that I think thematically fits into this episode, women supporting women. So before Murphy Brown, CBS had a show called Designing Women, which many of you must be extremely familiar with, because it is actually streaming, maybe even more than with Murphy Brown. Mm-hmm. But it never really was a ratings juggernaut necessarily. But in December, so technically the last season, they decided to pair it with Murphy Brown. Now, many times you would put a show that you wanted people to watch after the show that was getting more attention. Because the idea was that, oh, well, people will watch Murphy Brown and then it'll lead directly into Designing Women or whatever the next show is. And they're more likely to not turn their television off. Mm-hmm. This was done a lot with Thursday nights. That's how Cheers kind of became a hit. And then eventually that's what happened with Cheers, was you would air something after Cheers so that you could hopefully get the audience to just completely sort of change. So Monday nights started to sort of become this big powerhouse hit for CBS in the way that Thursdays had been in the 80s for NBC. Mm-hmm. There's this really interesting article specifically that talks about that. Jeff Sagansky talks about that Monday night is the best thing that has happened to us, but they particularly feel that Designing Women was helped by Murphy Brown. Murphy Brown is in its third year. Designing Women is in its fifth year. Diane English, the creator and chief writer of Murphy Brown, quote said, "We got talked about in our first year, then we got talked about more in our second year, and then last summer we started finishing in the top 10, which is also a big deal because they are up against Monday Night Football."
Yep. Monday night is hard, especially in the fall.
Yes. NBC had been running movies on Mondays, and Murphy Brown was aimed to appeal to a core audience of younger women, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah. I don't think I would have predicted that. I love that it was, but
40 and younger as opposed to 40 and older, maybe. Diane felt that the Emmy really made a difference because they were splashed all over every newspaper. If you had seen the show only a couple of times or your friends told you it was a good show, now you were seeing it called the best comedy on television and in your local paper. Yeah. This also, I think, is a testament to the time when, like, shows were given time to breathe, right? Like, it wasn't just like, well, it's not doing well in the first season, we're going to, you know, get rid of it. You know, we talked about in season one and two how the show was more of a critical darling. It sort of slowly kind of was becoming a hit. And then along with it, Designing Women then regularly started appearing in the top 10.
Hey.
So here are two shows that, you know, were really very much sort of helping each other. This article even says that only 2 years ago, CBS had almost no strength on Monday night. Murphy Brown was there, but was struggling. Designing Women was there, but not scheduled adjacent to Murphy Brown. Designing Women was successful, but not a hit. So it's like separately, they were doing okay. And then together, they became this amazing powerhouse hour of female comedy. Both shows, by the way, created by women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something also interesting is the article also references that Vice President Dan Quayle's favorite show is Major Dad.
Ding!
At the end of this season, Cheers was number one. And when I say season, I mean the 90 to 91 season. Cheers was number one with a 21 share. And Murphy Brown was tied at seventh with America's Funniest Home Videos for a 16.9.
Dang.
Pretty good. The top three shows are Cheers, 60 Minutes, and number three is Roseanne. And as we've talked about, Roseanne was always a hit. Also, I think a really interesting quote that I have from my scrapbook is a great way, I think, to sort of end this, is from a 28-year-old woman named Allison Stewart. And this is sort of a roundup of the season in Entertainment Weekly. And she says that on her must-see list of TV are what she calls the Women Power Hour, Murphy Brown and Designing Women, where there are no bimbos or bimbos are made fun of.
Huh. I mean, you know how I feel about the concept of a bimbo, but I understand it's the context in the quote there.
Yeah, and this is from 1990.
That is unique. Yeah.
Yeah, and also just
that's fascinating
to remind people, in 1987 was called the year of the bimbo. It was in all the papers. So this is a word.
It was that a very specific term of the time.
Yeah. So I think that in the context of the time, this person is probably referring to the fact that they don't like that word.
But the idea that like that concept is not welcome here.
Exactly,
which I love, because that's true. Even, you know, we look at a character like Corky that people could easily assume that that's exactly what they're doing, and her entire character is about being like, that's not true.
Yeah, and also a 24-year-old at the time, the young people.
The young people.
The young people. And they didn't want to cast a 40-year-old woman. Whatever. I think for people who are fans of Designing Women, you have Murphy Brown to thank for its success.
Thank you for listening, friends.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, please show us your support by
liking,
subscribing,
and interacting with us on social media.
Our handle everywhere is
at Murphy Brown Pod.
You can also email us at
murphybrownpod@gmail.com
or visit our website at
murphybrownpod.com.
Share us with your friends.
Give us a 5-star rating
wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by checking out our Patreon.
You can donate once
or be a recurring subscriber
and access exclusive deep dives on Murphy Brown and other related topics,
as well as bonus content we had to cut for time.
100% of what you donate goes towards creating this podcast.
So any way you are able to support, we deeply appreciate.
And we'll see you next time
for another edition of FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast. Murphy loves the smell of the food. It's kitchen. It's a chicken kitchen. Murphy loves the smell of the food. Again, a kitchen. Kitchen. Oh, my God, Lauren. Murphy loves the smell. I'm a blooper. I'm a walking, talking blooper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.